This is The God Show, a conversation about the human spirit with your host, Pat McMahon.
Most of the time, after that introduction, I'm delighted to be able to say, oh, what a show we've got coming up. It's going to change the way that you've been thinking about this or that. And it's almost always a very positive approach that I have, sincerely, knowing what the subject is and knowing who the guest is. In this case, I'm very positive because of the quality of the guest. But sadly, the next hour is going to be devoted to a horror story. A horror story that no one in Hollywood could ever create more frightening than the reality of the book Ghosts of the Orphanage. I don't want you to leave us now because you're thinking that this is going to be something that you're not going to be able to handle. You have to handle it so that it doesn't happen in your town, so that it doesn't happen in your community, so that it doesn't happen in your country, as it has happened, according to the author Christine Keneally, a journalist, an investigative reporter who went through so many stories, so many extreme adventures involving torture and death and mistreatment. And she investigated them all. You know why? Because of what I said you have to do now. Now you can buy the book and you can find out in detail what happened in these orphanages. Or you can just listen to the next hour and say, Christine, what can we do? Ghosts of the Orphanage. Christine Keneally, award-winning journalist, author, has written for The New Yorker, New York Times, Slate, Time, publications all over the... Her BuzzFeed news stories about crimes committed at these orphanages has gotten international attention, and we hope that that attention continues as a result of your visit with us, Christine, on The God Show. In spite of the frightening nature of the book, I welcome you, and I'm glad that we could do this hour together. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Pat. I really appreciate being here, and I appreciate your introduction so much. You're absolutely right. I think it's important that people understand the stories and ask themselves, did this happen where I live? Is this happening where I live? Might this happen again? Should I do something?
The real horror of the stories after chapter after chapter of Ghosts of the Orphanage, and we could also acknowledge the fact that that's plural, orphanages around the world with these kinds of horrors. And we are going to go into detail so that you know what Christine knows and what these children have known as they attempted to grow up. But the real horror is that it all really happened. It happened to children. How did it affect you, Christine, after you finished writing the book and chronicling these incidents, these experiences in detail? What happened to you?
Well, thank you, Pat. Thank you for that question. It was a real journey for me. I was with this story for at least 10 years. I'm an American-Australian journalist, so I write a lot for the United States, but I'm back based in Australia now, or I was 10 years ago when this began. And I stumbled into the story. I went to a conference. It was an archivist conference. People were talking about this group of people whose information had been withheld from them. And it was information like the names of siblings or whether they had siblings or who their parents were. It was so strange and intriguing to me. And I started digging further and further and started talking to individuals who began to tell me stories of abuses that they had experienced in 20th century childcare institutions. And some of them began to tell me stories about deaths that they'd witnessed. And initially, put the death stories aside, I just didn't really take them on. I understood that the abuse stories were very likely real. The witnesses were incredibly compelling. I believe they were telling me the truth.
Where did those stories take place, by the way?
Pardon, where did those stories take place?
Yes. Was this in Australia? Or was it America? Or was it in Vermont?
Right. Initially, the stories I started to hear were in Australia alone, but they were in different orphanages. And the more I spoke to people, the more I heard the stories. And then eventually, I pursued that line to the United States and started asking questions there. And, you know, lo and behold, the same kinds of stories. So as it slowly dawned on me in those first few years that it made no sense to not listen to the death stories, to not consider the death stories. In fact, it was illogical. If I believed the stories of physical abuse, stories like kids being thrown downstairs, held outside windows, beaten really violently, then I had to consider the possibility that the death stories were true. And taking that on emotionally and intellectually was really difficult initially. I went through a period a couple of years in where I would wake up out of really intense nightmares in the middle of the night. Just this sort of the change that I had to go through to abandon my sense that this couldn't happen. It's just too awful. And really begin to consider and accept the fact that actually it probably did and it needed serious investigation. Was very deep and very altering. And then certainly throughout the years following, as I sat with individuals, sat with incredible people and heard their stories. And in many cases, I was the first recipient or maybe the second recipient of those stories. They were 60, 70, 80 years old. And some of them had not told anyone before what had happened to them. So to experience that, to watch memories play out across their faces, to watch their bodies tense up as they remembered, as they went back in time and you know, re-experienced really some of that trauma. It was a lot. It certainly required that I change some things about my life so that I stayed strong enough, so that I had the endurance to keep listening. But, you know, it was a responsibility that I gladly took on, because to hear those stories and to realize that so little had been done about them felt like it became a mission for me. It became so important.
Children of all ages sent for an infinite number of reasons, and sometimes no reason at all, to institutions that were a part of communities and a part of cultures that we perhaps on the other side of the world were so proud of, and that we would visit as tourists, not knowing that this terror was taking place. And by the way, we're talking about something not from the past, because if all of you listening right now can remember news stories from this past year about bodies being unearthed in Canada on the properties of institutions, bodies being unearthed here in America on the properties of these same kinds of institutions this past year. Would you, Christine, please, and I don't want you to hold back, because I want the audience to know why it is that I responded to your book the way I have. Would you just right now, and I'm going to ask you to do this a couple of times through this hour, right now, pick any story of any child out of that huge number of children that you interviewed and that you read about and heard about. Pick right now, to start with, an example of one child in one institution and what happened to that child. Pick one.
Yes. Yes. Sally Dale. Sally Dale was her name. She was a little girl born in 1938 in Burlington, Vermont. She was born to two very young parents, married very young. I think her mother had four children under 3 or 4, you know, within a couple of years of marriage. So very difficult situation, not a lot of external family support. The family was in complete crisis very soon in, and my understanding is a local social worker suggested to them that their children might be better off in the local Catholic orphanage, where the nuns took really wonderful care of the children. They would get a fantastic education. And soon after, the parents split. And so that was what the decision was. So Sally was at the time only 2 years old, and she went into St. Joseph's for a brief period because she was so young. She was looked after by a lady across the road. It was an informal arrangement with the nuns. But she remembers that time as a happy one. It was a stable home. This woman loved her. She thought she was a delightful child. Sally was happy. And then fairly soon after that, she was taken across to the institution. Her brother was there. Her sister was there. But as is typical of so many of these places, she hardly ever saw them at all. And in her brother's case, almost never. The boys and the girls were separated. And there was no attempt made whatsoever to look after these kids' family connections and to keep them connected to one another. So Sally was taken onto a dorm room, and very early on, you know, became used to the routine of the place. It was extremely strict, harsh routine for young children. They were up at the crack of dawn. The nun would walk into the dorm room, sort of clacking these clappers together. This was a story I heard over and over and over. To wake the children up instantly out of bed, onto the floor, on their knees in morning prayer, straight to chapel, long mass, then breakfast, then school in the institution. And there was no connection to the outside world at all. Sally was effectively incarcerated along with all these other little children with all their various sad family histories and issues. But early on, she noticed that in the middle of the night, other girls were woken up and taken into another room by a nun. She was very scared about this. She didn't know what to do. She just sort of lay there in her bed. And these little kids in St. Joseph's were all supposed to sleep in exactly the same way every night. It's an impossible thing to ask a children to do. And yet they were asked to do it, and they were punished when they didn't do it. So they were supposed to take their hands and clasp them in prayer, lay their hands upon their pillow, place their head upon their hands, lie on their side, and not move, maintain that position for the rest of the night. So there was rules and control even around how these little children were supposed to sleep. So eventually Sally's turn arrived, and the nun came and got her in the middle of the night. She brought Sally into her room, and she sexually abused Sally, and Sally found it incredibly distressing. Very vividly memorable because it was so awful for her. It happened again a few different times. And Sally, who's someone I spent a lot of time writing about because she had such an extraordinary amount of moxie, of courage. She was known as stubborn. This was said as this sort of very negative, judgmental thing to her whole life in the orphanage. But in actual fact, it was her saving grace. She was an incredibly strong young kid. The last time it happened to her, she vomited on the nun, and the nun was so angry. She beat Sally. She sent her back to bed, but it was protective. It never happened to her again. That was just the beginning of the incredibly twisted and disturbing things that Sally had to contend with. When she was around 6 years old, she was moving dorm rooms, and a nun was walking her around the back of the orphanage and explaining various aspects of the orphanage to her. You know, when kids were different ages, they would sort of graduate into different rooms. There would be a different nun in charge and different rules about where they could go and what they could do at the orphanage. So Sally remembers, and she recounted this, let me see, almost 50 years later in a deposition in the 1990s, she did it with just such a vivid sense of the trauma of it and the reality of it. I saw her on video, and it's just an extraordinary thing to watch. She heard the sound of smashing glass. She looked up, and she saw a young boy flying through the air. She noticed there was a nun at a window and she recognized the habit of the nun, and she saw that the nun's arms were out in front of her, pushed out. You know, she described this physically. She modeled it 50 years later in this deposition. The boy hit the ground before her and the other nun. And what Sally said at that moment too was that he kind of bounced. It was this really strange moment in her deposition. She was being interviewed by a defense lawyer. He very skeptically, censoriously said, "What? He bounced?" And made it seem like she was making something up, like she was saying something silly. But this poor little boy hit the ground. His body bounced a little bit. He came back down again. And Sally understood at a very, very primal level that she'd just seen somebody die. I actually interviewed a forensic pathologist more than 50 years later after I'd heard this story. And his take on it was that that's actually what a body that size would do if it was thrown from that height. The nun was standing up on the fourth floor of the building. I can't even begin to tell you the rest of the things that Sally witnessed as she went on. There were other incidents of what appeared to be murders, deaths, near deaths. Sally herself saved a girl from going out a window more than 10 years later while she was still at the orphanage. She was taken out of high school. She was actually allowed to go to high school for a little while. She was taken out of high school. She was made really an indentured servant inside the orphanage. She would get up and help make breakfast for the rest of the kids. Often with kids like Sally, whose parents were very disconnected from their lives in the orphanage. There were some parents who, for various reasons, or, you know, a single parent, a single dad, a single mom, sort of hung in there, were able to either financially or emotionally, and they would visit at least once a week. The visiting was very curtailed, but they had a presence. Sally's parents rarely showed up at all. So the nuns were able to get Sally to do essentially whatever they wanted. And by the time Sally left the orphanage in her early 20s, she'd been there for almost her entire life. And she had witnessed the abuse of other little children. Again, she had intervened. You know, strong Sally had tried to stop many things along the way too. But, you know, in the 1990s, when lawyers were trying to sort of poo-poo the stories that people were telling, saying mm-hmm. it was too outlandish, it was hard to believe they were making it up, or in some cases where they acknowledged the trauma of individuals who'd spent time in the orphanages, what they would say was, no, the trauma happened before you went into the orphanage. It was inside your family, or it was after you left the orphanage. But Sally was a creature of the orphanage. She'd been there since she was two. So she was incredibly important for every other orphan story in the book, because Sally showed she was there the whole time. She could speak to what it meant to have been an entirely embedded child of that place.
And Christine Keneally, recognizing the fact that the psychological abuse, the sexual abuse, the torture, and sometimes eventually winding up with the death of children and babies, you still have acknowledged the fact that there are those listening to this program right now who are saying, oh, well, she's just one of those journalists that wants to sell books. And so she just has created something far beyond reality. And Christine, if you could briefly just simply say something to those people, and non-believers, as you know, are more rampant now probably than ever before, but say something to the people who are listening right now who are the doubters, so that they too can feel a responsibility to do something about it in their community. Why should they believe you?
Yeah. Well, firstly, I want to acknowledge that I empathize with that position. I really do. I came to this story from a place of pretty heavy skepticism about some of these stories, but I came to fully understand the reality of this place. And, you know, I would encourage people, if they want to read the article or the book, or just to understand that in the book, you know, I began with government inquiries. I began with, years-long investigations from federal and state governments all around the world. They did not happen in the United States, which is why I think the skepticism is still so ingrained there. But in the early 2000s, governments began to finally listen to the people who'd been in orphanages. There were very formal processes of investigation and witness statements. And the evidence contained in all the reports from all these inquiries is very profound on its face. But once you start reading them and get into them, what is undeniable, what is so powerful is the ways in which these stories corroborate each other. This happened all over the world, and the stigma of having been in an orphanage, of having been abused as a child, led many people to hold on to these stories and not even tell their spouses for many decades. So inside these formal reports, and replicated very much in my investigation, was a series of interviews where people said for the first time what had happened to them. They hadn't read these stories because, of course, these stories have not been told before. They weren't influenced by other people's stories. They were just talking about them. And yet it was uncanny how similar the things that they said were to children inside that institution who they'd never spoken to, children from other institutions in the same country that they had no idea existed, and children from other institutions across the world. Just one quick example is the way kids who wet the bed were treated. It's a very common thing, of course, for little children to wet their beds, and even more so when they're in a situation like life in an institution where they feel uncomfortable and at dis-ease, and it's just a pretty normal childhood thing. So kids in institutions across the world were shamed for having wet the bed when morning came and the nun or whoever it was who was looking after that dorm would discover that a bed was wet. Often the kids had their wet sheets draped around them. They were marched up and down in the dorm or down the hallway. The other children were always enjoined to laugh at them. In some institutions, different institutions across the world, there would be songs they were made to sing at the poor little kid who'd wet their bed to shame and humiliate them in some very misguided notion that that would actually help them stop wetting the bed. So the mesh of corroboration that you stumble into once you start investigating these stories is very profound. It's not possible to make that up.
Christine, I'm Catholic. I come from generations of Irish Catholicism. Is it primarily a sin of my church what has gone on in these institutions around the country? Because through the book, some of the mistreatment, no, it seemed as if most of the mistreatment, most of the torture, most of the abuse was at the hands of priests and nuns. Is it a sin of my church?
Yes and no, Pat. Certainly, there were other institutions run by other religions in the United States and elsewhere in the world, and even those that were sort of nominally non-religious, run by the state, and they took children from all sorts of backgrounds. Many of these stories happened in many of these institutions. I focused on the Catholic institutions because there were overwhelmingly more of them. So it certainly is the case that many of the stories are Catholic stories.
Tell the story of another child.
Oh, gosh, there's so many of them. I became friends with a man called Walter, who also was at St. Joseph's in Burlington. And I met Walter and his friend Ray down in Florida. They'd moved down there. They were both in their 70s at the time. It was a really fascinating afternoon. We sat in Walter's living room. There were a number of small dogs barking around us very happily. And they proceeded to jokingly tell me all these incredible things that they had witnessed. They were somewhat unusual. Often people leave orphanages and don't stay connected to anyone who was there. It's just incredibly painful to get on with your life and have the reality of what you went through, you know, having to face that in the face of a friend. But these two called each other brothers, although they were not related at all. And they stayed very connected throughout their lives. And by the time I met them, they were living just, they were neighbors essentially. So we sat down and they proceeded to tell me about just the loneliness of the institution, the casual cruelty of the nuns who would just physically beat them for doing the wrong thing, hit them with implements. There was no love or kindness there at all for these boys. That was an incredibly sad backdrop. And yet there were far more specific things that happened to the boys. Walter told me about a particular nun whose favorite thing was to tell the boys that they needed to go out to the grotto. They had to cut a switch off the rose bushes there, and then she would whip them with that switch. And this is, I don't know what's happened to roses since. This is an old world rose, and there were many thorns on the switch, but the nun would beat them with that. They spent some time in a sort of an annex, essentially, of the orphanage. It was called Don Bosco, and boys from 14 years up.
Often where was that, Christine?
Oh, Don Bosco. It was in Burlington, Vermont. It was all on the same property. It was all the same place, but just priests ran that, so there were no nuns there. And Walter, when I first met with Walter, he said, "You know, tell me what you've learned, but don't tell me anything about John Glancy." That was a priest that he greatly admired. He said, "I don't want to hear any stories about him. He was one of the good guys," although he was clearly conflicted, because Walter knew all those years later that for the sheer amount of exploitation that was occurring at St. Joseph's, it was hard to imagine that a priest who was high up in the hierarchy there, which this man was, didn't know. And I could tell that Walter was troubled by the idea that this man who'd helped him, even after he'd left the orphanage, might be implicated. But he was such an important figure to him. So Walter, Walter's this great, he's just this very plain spoken, he just shoots straight from the hip kind of guy. And after the BuzzFeed News article was published, after the Attorney General began a restorative justice process and Walter began to participate in that, you know, that was very challenging for many people in many ways. It was so triggering. It was so emotionally difficult for them. But they finally came to a sort of natural end of one of those processes. And Walter, I was back in Burlington. Walter sat me down and he said to me, "You know what? I've been sitting here for all these years now, and I've been looking at people wanting them to tell their stories, and I haven't been telling my story." And he told me that after he left Don Bosco's, that priest who he had felt such loyalty to had taken him in for a while. Walter was 13 years old. He was a homeless child. It was the 1950s. There was so little support for someone like him. But over the summer, this priest said he could stay at the rectory and he would, you know, get him to do some jobs and he would help look after him. And Walter had been very slowly and very painfully grappling with the fact over the previous few years that, in fact, the priest had sexually abused him as well when he was at the rectory. And it wasn't that he'd forgotten it. It was just a part of his story that he hadn't want to acknowledge, that he hadn't want to deal with, but it had sort of taken going through this restorative justice process, watching other survivors grapple with the incredible challenge of telling their story, and finally realizing that the one person he'd been hanging on to, this man had been this kind of symbol that there was good in the world, there was good in that world at least, that actually he was a predator as well. He had exploited Walter, he'd taken advantage of his vulnerability, and, you know, and then had denied it, of course.
We're talking with Christine Keneally, journalist with many credits, but we're talking about her book, Ghosts of the Orphanage. How many countries did you personally investigate?
I haven't thought about the number, but it was Australia, it was the United States. I spoke to many people in Ireland and England as well, conducted a few interviews with people who knew something about systems in France and Germany.
My God.
Yeah, sorry.
Oh,
yeah,
no, just the idea, though, that you had all of those different varied cultures and backgrounds, and so many of the stories were almost exactly the same. Horrendous abuse, not just rigid, strict rules of the institution, the terror that the kids went through. Where did those kids, for the most part, come from? They didn't come from families that were parentless. I've never really quite understood how they wound up in the institutions to begin with.
Yeah, Pat, it's so strange. That was a learning for me early on. Most of the orphans, the so-called orphans in orphanages, were not orphans at all. It was actually very rare to be what they called a full orphan in an orphanage, to have lost both of your parents. So this was, these were children of poverty, essentially. That was the biggest common denominator. And then inside that, these were children like whose parents had split up and there was very little support for them, whose fathers had died in the war and whose mothers needed to work full time in order to pay for them in whatever way she could. Absolutely, certainly it was also the case, very dysfunctional families where the children were being abused in the family, and the state or the priest came along to try to take children from those situations. And certainly some have told me that, they were much better off in the institution. And I absolutely believe that. But kids where, for whatever reason, their families were unable to care for them and there was no support of any kind to help keep families together at that time.
But the stories must have gotten out of the institution, considering the massive numbers of children in that large number of institutions around the world. How could law enforcement have been indifferent? How could the diocese of Burlington, Vermont, a small community like that, have been indifferent? Why didn't the Vatican know about it?
Oh, I am sure the Vatican did know about it, Pat. And, and I'd love to hear your take on this as well. You were there at the time, but I think today, maybe it's a little hard for younger generations to really grasp the power of the church in local communities all over the United States and certainly everywhere else in the world. And the idea that a priest was a god, certainly nuns believe that, the children in the orphanage believe that, and communities to some very large extent seemed to hold priests up to that kind of, give them that kind of perch as well. So there were really brave kids from all over the place who ran away, who tried to escape. And some of them ran back to families and some of them ran to the police, or they were picked up by the police in their attempt to flee. And I've heard so many stories of kids who told the police what was happening to them in there. And invariably in those early years, in the 40s and the 50s, they just weren't believed. The police just returned them. And there was this sense that the nuns could do no wrong, that if the priest said something, then it was absolutely the case. As the system started to break down, become less powerful after Vatican II, after the 60s, when those really ancient structures and belief systems and the sense that scandal must be avoided at all cost, as that started to sort of dissolve, kids got more traction. There were stories where, yes, the police officer returned them to the orphanage, but they actually stayed and questioned the nuns for a while. Sadly, they often ended up believing the stories, but they actually asked questions. There were stories where families just returned the kids to the orphanage and became angry at them because they said such terrible things about priests and nuns. There was very much this attitude that if you said something horrible about a priest or a nun, it wasn't because it was true. It was because you were being terrible or scandalous or abusive or harmful yourself, and or just inappropriate as a child to speak such things. Again, as people began to understand more about how these things could happen, there were certainly more stories of kids being believed by their families and kept out of these places.
Tell the story, Christine, if you will. And I keep asking you for specific stories because I want the listeners right now to know that while it might not be happening down the road in that institution, because there are some wonderful organizations taking care of children around the world, we want to remind people that they're not all free of sin themselves by any means. Tell the story about the priest at the acting camp.
Ah, my story, you mean?
The priest that was conducting a camp where enthusiastic children wanted to go into the theater, and this is where they could learn the background of the theater. Yes.
Right. So Pat, this forms part of why I ended up being engaged by this story, why it became my mission. Because so this happened to me when I was 14 years old, and a friend of mine asked if I wanted to go to an acting camp, and I was so thrilled by the idea. I secretly dreamed about becoming an actor. It seemed like such a wonderful adventure. And so persuaded my parents to let me go. It was run by a priest who was a friend of my friend's family.
Excuse me. And, once again, geographically, are we talking about Australia or the United States?
This one actually happened in Melbourne, Australia.
Okay.
And but you know, kids across the States have exactly the same stories as the stories I'm about to tell you. And this is why I told this story in the book, because I know how universal it is too. So we went to this property. It was about an hour out of town. It was this lovely rural area. And the building, it was this priest's private retreat. Lots of Catholic kids have experienced this as well. Priests would have, you know, outside of their parishes, country houses or houses near the beach. And the structure was, it was kind of like a hall, but there was just one room in it that had a door that closed, and that was the priest's bedroom. And so super excited to go, really thrilled. There's a bunch of other kids there. I went to Catholic girls' school, Pat, and so it was pretty exciting stuff to be in a room with a bunch of boys as well. Weirdly, there were no sort of acting classes on that first day. I guess it was a kind of just getting to know you social situation. But that night it was very cold. There was an open fire. My friend and I and the priest, who was her family friend, and this other boy, we were sitting in front of the fire. The boy was really cute, Pat. I still remember this lovely thick mop of hair that he had. I was quite excited to be there. And the priest began to talk to us about the meaning of love and the meaning of trust. And it was very long, convoluted sort of preaching. I wasn't paying a lot of attention, but somehow we arrived at this point at the end of what he was saying, where he said that he thought it'd be really great if we showed each other real love, and we showed each other that we understood what the meaning of trust was. And we, the four of us, went into his bedroom and shut the door and took off all our clothes. Because if we did that, then it would mean that we really believed in each other and we understood what trust meant.
And how old were you then?
I was 14 years old. Mm. My dad was a very old school Catholic, very strict, great moral clarity. You know, right was right and wrong was wrong for my dad. And also, you know, raised his children to be fairly inhibited young Catholic girls. And so I had this very strange experience that night of feeling my dad speak through me. I heard his voice come out of my mouth and I thundered the word no. And the priest was really shocked. I was really shocked. I didn't know what had happened to me. And the priest looked very shocked, very upset, and he became very cold, and he kind of withdrew from me for the rest of the night, and then for the rest of the weekend shunned me, wouldn't even look at me where I was standing. There were no acting classes that weekend. So years later, I learned that, in fact, that priest had been arrested not long after for the rape of children, both boys and girls, at that camp where he took them. But just in the years preceding the night that I was there, and in fact, he was one of Australia's worst predators, or certainly one of the worst predators that had been discovered. He ended up in court again and again and again on many charges. He spent much of the rest of his life in jail. He died in jail. To the end, he clearly believed that he had done nothing wrong. He threatened children, you know, that he would kill their parents if they told him. I was very lucky to have avoided that night, but I felt this great sense of responsibility learning about this years later and realizing for the many, many children who have been abused by Catholic priests, there are so many more of us who came close, who saw there was something weird going on, who through the luck of having strong parents or supportive parents or just a little bit more support somehow were not drawn into that very ugly web. And just the feeling that, you know, we really needed to reach out and do something about those that had, you know, those that had been much more profoundly affected. And one of the things I found out about this priest was that he also spent a lot of time in this orphanage called St. Augustine's in a neighboring city. It was run by the Christian Brothers. They are absolutely an organization that perpetrated some of the most sadistic and disturbing assaults upon children in places like these. So he would come and go. So I realized that even though he ended up in jail based on many charges, often they were brought by the families of these children, I don't think he was ever investigated for what undoubtedly took place inside that orphanage. And so it felt to me that that was something I needed to do.
Christine Keneally, in the book, Ghosts of the Orphanage, you've told us so many stories that were told to you as you interviewed the victims of this kind of abuse at orphanages in so many different parts of the world. And you just told us a story about what happened to you and could have happened to you in greater detail. But the one thing in the book that I never really clearly understood, that wasn't clear to me, and I'm going to ask you now, as a result of that abundant amount of material, often at the hands of these members of the religious, no matter how you were raised, are you now anti-Catholic?
I'm certainly anti the parts of the institution that still seek to deny what happened. I would absolutely not describe myself as anti-Catholic or anti-religious in any way. There were so many survivors, Pat, some of whom abandoned religion altogether, couldn't stomach it, couldn't tolerate the hypocrisies they had dealt with. There were others who changed religion, who became more set in their religion, and they found great strength in it. They found enormous strength in it. And when I spoke to people and they ended by saying, God bless you, you know, I absolutely receive that as a message of love and care. But the institution that still seeks to deny, the institution that continues to exploit these people, the institution that in the 1990s, when these people first started to come forward, did not own what they had done, but rather further traumatized the victims by telling them that they were liars, I very much still feel committed to exposing those people, that institution, and doing everything I can to make sure that justice is served up to them.
So many of those children grew to adults who then realized that if they were to lead any kind of life with normalcy, they would have to have help and they would have to go to therapists. With the remarkable number of people who did just that I was reading in your book about, Why didn't the therapist go to the authorities?
Yeah, that's such a good question. People did. And it wasn't just therapists. I spoke to a man. He was in jail when I spoke to him. He had abused children himself as an adult. He had been abused in the orphanage as a child. He told both a prison guard and a psychologist when he was incarcerated 10 years before I met him that he'd seen a young girl die in an institution and he'd watched her body be disposed of. They believed him and they actually did try to do something at the time, both of them separately. They didn't know each other at the time as well. And I think there are stories like this all over as well and some of the psychologists. But I guess the larger culture just wasn't ready to hear the story. So it didn't really go anywhere. And, you know, there were the stories of children. And so without this corroborating sort of larger group of people telling exactly the same kinds of stories, they were very isolated stories. And a lot of these people were incredibly traumatized as well. And, you know, now psychologists even are so much better at understanding the impact of trauma and the way it affects people and how it affects their demeanor and the way they tell stories and the way they remember things as well. But I think earlier on, maybe back in the 90s, even though that understanding was beginning to be developed, it just wasn't really embedded even inside those professions.
The stories that I know you read, I don't remember that you investigated any of them, about the indigenous children who either left the tribal areas on the reservations or were sent away to schools and then abused, some of their bodies found on the properties, as I mentioned earlier. Were those stories that were primarily the United States and Canada, did you find them similar to the ones that you investigated?
Very much so. There's an enormous overlap between the experience of Indigenous children, and it actually includes Australia as well, but also in the United States and Canada, and the children in more urban areas who ended up inside institutions. And I spoke to a number of people. I traveled with a man called Ken Bearchief in Washington State, and he had been on his own mission to unearth these stories of murder as well, and he'd been trying to do everything he could to track down stories that he was hearing. And he introduced me to a number of people who'd had very, very similar experiences. So from the perspective of the actual children inside the institutions, many, many of the experiences, much of the daily life was very, very similar. And sometimes it was the same individuals who were in these orphanages, the same priests, the same nuns, and very much the same system. For Indigenous kids in the United States, in Canada and elsewhere, there was this additional terrible layer of experience to do with the fact that they were native children. And so they were even more isolated to begin with in the institutions they were in. They experienced just humiliating treatment because of their culture, because of the languages they spoke. Children were punished for speaking the native language. Some of those stories also really, really similar across institutions and across the world. Children having pins, having their tongues poked with pins because they were speaking in their actual language. There was a lot of shame and mortification associated with just their own cultural behaviors. And then, of course, even less belief when these stories started to be told, you know, decades later, and people sought some kind of justice.
What's being done, Christine? What's being done somewhere in any of those countries in order to make sure that it doesn't happen, particularly as universally as it has happened in the past? Has it really dramatically changed and lessened?
The experience of children in institutions, is that what you're asking, Pat?
Yes.
Well, it's hard to tell. I mean, a lot of children are now in the foster care system, which is both I think for many, better and worse. For some who end up in a good family, that's really lovely. But for other kids, there's even less visibility inside a foster family. And so things can happen that have no corroborating evidence or no corroborating stories at all. So that can be just incredibly difficult for kids in that situation. There certainly aren't institutions in the way there were now. The ones that closed down in the 70s in places like the United States and Canada, but there are places like that in developing countries, sometimes run by the same organizations, for example, the Christian Brothers, who ran these utter houses of horror in places like the United States and Australia many decades ago. I haven't begun to investigate what's going on inside those places. I feel very concerned, though, particularly for ones that are run by the same institutions.
What is it that you can suggest right now to people in every community listening to this program? What can they do in order to make sure that it never happens again?
So the beginning of that process, the first thing to do is just to start to tell the stories, to acknowledge the stories. Pat, every second person I spoke to in the United States when I would explain that I was writing a book about orphanages, they would, you know, they would stop for a minute and they would say, oh, yeah, my uncle was in a place like that. Or my great-great-grandmother mm-hmm. grew up in an orphanage. Or there was a place like that in our town. It was just in the outskirts near the river. And I remember wondering what happened inside there. This is one of the most extraordinary stories I have ever investigated because it is so invisible. And yet almost everyone that I spoke to knew that they existed and knew that there was some story in their family. So please just think about your family and ask your mom, look through the letters from your grandparents, go back through those family albums or ask your neighbor, you know, oh, do you remember those places? Did you know what happened inside there? Because I think it's that sort of ground level collective knowledge that's what really leads to change, that what really makes people feel like this should never happen again. And all those stories deserve to be told. And for the children who never made it out or who grew up, who became adults and died of old age and never had their stories honored or told, they deserve that acknowledgement as well. So that would be the first thing I would say.
We only have 2 minutes left, Christine, and I really would like to close on one of the few positive notes out of this story. We've met so many villains on this program and in reading your book. Tell us about a couple of the heroes, if you will, in just a couple of minutes.
I would love to. There are so many, Pat. And this is a very dark fairy tale that is actually true. But many of the children who passed through this world in this terribly dark place, they came out and they survived. And even though it took many decades, their stories of resilience and courage in eventually telling their story and creating change in their worlds are absolutely incredible. So in Burlington, Vermont, as in Melbourne, Australia, as in many other towns in the world, the survivors of orphanages are the bravest, most incredible people you'll ever meet. And they're agitating right now. They're getting change in their communities, in their governments. They're making sure that statutes of limitations are repealed so people can get justice. They're telling their stories. They're creating memorials. It's really the most beautiful and amazing thing to watch their commitment, not just to having the truth told, but to making sure it never happens to another child again.
That it never happens to another child again. I can't think of a better way to leave our audience now with that thought and the fact that there are activists making sure that it doesn't happen in their community. Ghosts of the orphanage, they're still haunting us. Thanks to the investigative work of Christine Kennealy, K-E-N-N-E-A-L-L-Y. Is there an institution somewhere in your town, somewhere in the outskirts of your city, check it out, won't you? And if somebody says why, you tell them it's because you found out about some things that need to be looked at on The God Show. I'm Pat McMahon.